Okay, Nicole, pop quiz.
Oh, Raleigh. Okay, what's up?
Global warming. It's getting too hot. Uh-huh. What causes heat?
The sun?
Exactly. So here's the climate solution. We're going to send up thousands of airplanes to release a gas to blot out the sun.
Oh, did you hear this plan from the Riddler? Raleigh, I'm really excited about today's episode because this climate myth is one that got me.
Uh-oh. Yeah. It's coming from inside the house.
It's coming from inside the house. It's time for me to own up to it. Today, we are talking about something called geoengineering. Raleigh, are you familiar with geoengineering?
Yeah-ish. I know it's broadly like messing with the atmosphere to raise or lower the amount of something in the atmosphere in order to raise or lower the temperature of the Earth.
Yeah, that's basically exactly it in very nonspecific words.
Thank you. You'll never pin me down.
I was first drawn to geoengineering because I got this book, which I have in my hands, called The Planet Remade.
She's not lying. She's
How
holding a
book. Geoengineering could change the world.
Oh.
And I would actually say it's not much of an exaggeration to say that this book is why I got involved in climate action.
Really?
Yeah. It's, I think after I sort of decided that I wanted to like leave my job in the blogosphere and like work in the public sector and work in climate change, I don't remember how I found this book. I think maybe I literally like went to the climate section of the library or something and was like, this one looks good. And I got it. And it really informed the way that I thought about the Earth system for a few years. This is by a guy named Oliver Morton, who is a science journalist. He's a briefings editor at The Economist. As far as I can tell, he's like, he fully buys into geoengineering, but he seems like a nice enough guy. I don't think he has like fossil fuel funding or anything behind him.
Gotcha.
He does, however, have some of the craziest facial hair I've ever seen.
Oh, man.
So I want you to look at his author photo in this book.
What in the absolute fuck is this guy wearing on his face?
I would describe it as geometric.
I mean, it sort of looks like this is weird. If you were trying to make the silhouette of a bicycle facing forward on your face, that's the facial hair you would give me. The bicycle, please.
Yeah, it's like it's very pronounced mutton chops that are up very high, close to his eyes, and then a strong goatee, but then shaved cheeks and jawline.
And Nicole, I'm going to go ahead and say there is no way you can describe what this man's facial hair looks like accurately. Like, I have no reference for this. I've never seen somebody with facial hair like this before.
Yeah, like, he seems like a perfectly nice guy, so this does feel mean, but I have never seen facial hair before like this.
I mean, it's not mean if we're maybe, we think it's cool. I mean, we don't, so it is mean, but...
Yes.
I'm just like imploring you, go, if you're out there listening, pause this right now and go look up Oliver Morton's facial hair. It's very interesting.
You can even do it while you listen to the podcast.
No. You better pause it.
Okay.
Don't forget to come back.
So we're going to talk a little bit more about The Planet Remade later when we get into like the specifics of geoengineering. But for a long time, I was walking around at that point, I was in Los Angeles, and people were like, Nicole, what's going on with climate change? And I was like, don't worry, we're going to fix it. Mm. Like, there's this thing called geoengineering. We're going to be fine. And now I have since walked back my stance on that.
Gotcha.
Pretty substantially. But before we get into the book specifically, like, let's talk a little bit about what geoengineering is. The loosest definition, which is basically what you said, is any intentional large-scale effort to manipulate climate, typically with the intent of mitigating or managing the impacts of climate change.
Okay.
And there's a lot of different ways to do that. It's typically either reflecting light and heat away from the planet or by sucking carbon out of the atmosphere and sequestering it.
Mm.
And to that extent, I guess you could consider the climate movement generally as kind of a form of geoengineering, since we're trying to not emit so much carbon. It is a pretty wiggly definition. There's this professor at UChicago named David W. Keith, who wrote a whole paper about the history of geoengineering and the climate. Keith says that the distinction between ICM, which is industrial carbon management, and geoengineering is both imprecise and interesting. So the difference between just like managing carbon and what is considered geoengineering. Having read his paper, I would say it's not really interesting, not really enough for the podcast anyway. But basically, they draw the line of geoengineering at managing carbon once it's already in the atmosphere. So by their standard, reducing emissions isn't geoengineering.
Okay. All right.
So once it's already up there and you either like reflect light away so heat doesn't get trapped, or whether you pull carbon out of the atmosphere, that's geoengineering. But putting a cap on top of your natural gas plant so that carbon emissions don't leak out does not count as geoengineering.
Gotcha. It's sort of like, I guess we're sleeping a little bit on the word engineer in geoengineering. Mm-hmm. It's like going up and doing shit to the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Engineering a solution in
you know,
post.
It's interesting that you bring that up because something that we're going to get into a little later is that the word geoengineering makes it seem a lot more precise than it is.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Interesting, like Keith defines interesting.
I would say 20% more interesting than
wow.
Keith defines interesting.
Okay.
So this is one of those things where like the people who are proponents of it, I think in general are like pretty well-meaning people who do want to fight climate change and who do believe this is the solution. I don't think that generally they're trying to like mask any sinister intentions, or sometimes their intentions are to make money, but they are very clearly stating that. But it's not like Exxon is secretly out there, you know, trying to fund a big space shield to prevent the sun from getting to Earth.
So just real quick, I got a clarifying question.
Yeah.
The two big forms of geoengineering that I am familiar with so far in my limited education on it are either sucking carbon out of the atmosphere so it doesn't absorb so much infrared radiation, or putting like a reflective gas, like a phosphorus or a sulfate gas in the upper atmosphere to reflect sun away.
Yeah.
Are there a lot more major forms of this?
Not really. The sulfates is the big one. There's also another thing getting a little bit of buzz right now because there's just a big New York Times piece on it.
Our podcast?
It's not our podcast, but that was also in the New York Times. Make sure to check out the New York Times.
Yeah.
The print journalism needs your help. Please check out the New York Times. There was a New York Times piece about a theory that we could put a big parasol in outer space.
A parasol to us non-French assholes is is just an umbrella?
Like a sun shield. Yeah.
Okay.
We wouldn't put a big umbrella up there. That would be ridiculous.
Hang on. That's what a parasol is, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
But it's a sun shield. And that would go in outer space, like outside of our atmosphere.
Got it. So like those an IUD kind of for the sun.
I don't think you know what an IUD is.
Maybe you're right.
I guess an IUD is sort of a parasol of the uterus in a way.
Your words, not mine. From your words to God's ears, Nicole.
Yeah, look, science education is lacking in this country. And I think if anybody wants to learn about their changing bodies, then our podcast is the place for them to turn.
Nicole, I'm so sorry. Did I ever tell you about the worst experience I had as a tutor when I was teaching AP biology? And I had to go tutor this precocious 14-year-old girl.
Uh-huh.
And the lesson we had to start on was the menstrual cycle, and she had never heard of it.
What?
And so I had to like talk her.
That is like so irresponsible on the part of her parents.
A lot of people, a lot of mistakes had to be made to put me in the scenario of like teaching this girl about the menstrual cycle for the first
when
ever time.
I found out about it when my mom told me about it. I was like, what? Did she have that reaction to you?
She was just like, it felt like she was just like, all I have to do is get through this hour of listening to this dipshit try to explain this, and then I'm going to talk to my mom, and that's going to be the rest of the night.
I can't.
She got a 5 on the AP exam, so
I mean,
I don't know what to tell you.
Well, good for her.
Yeah.
And good for you for being so aware of women's bodies.
I mean, I was just reading from the textbook.
You know, that's more than I could say for some men. Anyway, what were we talking about?
Parasols.
Oh, parasol in space. Yeah. Right. Okay. So those are like the two main ways to like increase the reflectivity around the Earth that direct the sun away from hitting us in the first place.
Mm.
And then there's also methods for taking carbon out of the atmosphere. Some of those we're not going to talk about today. Direct air capture is one. That's the one that really the fossil fuel companies are most invested in.
Mm.
But that's like such a big topic. And it's also something that you covered extensively in grad school.
Yeah.
So I would like to save that for an episode for you. So we're not going to talk about that today.
Let's chop that off for a different episode.
Let's chop it off for a different episode. But we are going to talk a little bit about reflecting the sun away from Earth via sulfate aerosols or a big parasol in space.
I shall block out the sun unless the U.S. government releases this general.
Exactly.
Okay, gotcha.
I would say that the thing that connects all of these is that they're often solutions proposed by a group called eco-modernists. Mm. And there's a guy who writes, I think, really well about geoengineering and kind of like the cultural and sociopolitical implications. And his name is Kevin Surprise. And I think he's so smart. And his papers are so good. He's a visiting lecturer in environmental science at Mount Holyoke.
Kevin Surprise.
I was hoping we could brush past it because he seems like a nice guy.
And surprise guest, Kevin Surprise.
So Kevin Surprise talks a lot about geoengineering, particularly in the context of like progressive politics. And he wrote that a common but misguided critique of solar geoengineering links it to the fossil fuel industry. While it may ultimately provide a boon to fossil capital, the core funders and researchers are united by an ideology best labeled as green capitalist eco-modernism. And what eco-modernism is basically is people who are really committed capitalists think that we can, through technology, basically keep our economic system operating as usual, but use these new advances in, for example, geoengineering to dominate the environment so that we don't have to suffer the negative consequences of those actions.
Got it. And that sort of bumps up against the like infinite growth model that capitalism demands. But
yes.
Nicole, I think Kevin Surprise is onto something.
I think so. He describes it as a tactic for enabling incremental, market-driven decarbonization and says that it's a tool for class compromise between fossil and climate capital. So it's basically a way that people who have really succeeded in our current economic system, think like Bill Gates and Richard Branson, who
LeBron
are both
James.
Big proponents of solar geoengineering. Oh. I haven't talked to LeBron James personally about solar geoengineering. Be interested to hear his thoughts. But they're people who have like done very well under our current system and are invested in keeping it that way, but are also like not so delusional that they think that we cannot do anything about climate change. So they're looking to technology to fix that problem as opposed to like wildly adjusting our way of life.
Gotcha. So they're like, we're going to use our tech, which, and we're going to invest in this tech. So it's actually going to probably be really profitable for us. And that tech is going to be used at a large scale, deployed all over the world to mitigate sunlight, heating, and that's going to save us.
Exactly. Okay. And kind of the main critique of it is that it's sort of magical thinking about like we can keep extracting all of these resources and that by doing more, we can somehow have less impact. It is kind of based in like a colonial mindset of like we, the rich white people, are going to fix it. And like people in developing countries and people who might be hurt by our current like extractive economy and like our current ways of deploying fossil fuels don't really have a seat at the table to talk about it. So we're not solving problems for them. So it's intermingled with a lot of issues, but it's basically like tech guys seeing tech solutions for these problems.
Gotcha. I guess whenever I think about like tech guys being like, this tech solution is going to change everything, I immediately wonder like, okay, that's what you said about the metaverse, and that's what you said about Bitcoin.
Yeah. I just read this book by Paris Marx. Paris Marx is a tech reporter who is, like, I think, very, like, astutely critical of the tech industry. And this book, Road to Nowhere, that's the title of it. Really good. Highly recommend it. But his, like, critique is, like, these billionaires see something that's a problem for them, and then they figure out, like, what's the first solution that would solve this problem for me? So, like, Elon Musk came up with the Hyperloop when he was stuck in traffic, and he was like, what if I just had a tunnel to my office? This would fix the problem for everybody. It's like, that's what are you doing? So this is a little bit like that. But let's talk a little bit about the history of geoengineering. And it's important to understand the history in this case because it reveals some pretty compelling reasons that probably we should look a little bit skeptically at geoengineering. People have always wanted to control the weather for a variety of reasons, largely agricultural, but also so that you can shred some sweet, sweet pow pow.
If we want to control the weather, why don't we just ask the Jews?
Canceled. But like real research kind of started developing in this area in the 1900s, again, largely agricultural. In the USSR, in 1932, they founded the Leningrad Institute of Rainmaking, which researched cloud seeding using calcium chloride. Mm. Cloud seeding, by the way, makes clouds bigger and whiter. There's various chemicals that can do it. Calcium chloride, silver iodide, dry ice will do it. Basically, in order for water to form droplets, it has to have a nucleus of something. A lot of times that's like dust, but like silver iodide will do it. If you put a little silver iodide up there, it'll start attracting water to it, and that'll form water droplets that are big enough to create clouds.
Okay. And then I guess it'll sort of preemptively rain.
Yeah, okay. Sometimes. I didn't look too much into cloud seeding specifically, but you can do kind of different. You can make clouds bigger. You can make it rain.
Yeah, I remember hearing like when I was in elementary school, like China was making it rain before big parades so that they wouldn't rain on the parade.
We still do a lot of cloud seeding all over.
Really?
Yeah, I think in the American West, we do quite a bit of cloud seeding.
Wow.
So that's something that's still happening, but that tends to be more for weather modification than climate. One thing that's interesting is that a lot of the goal of like early large scale, at this point, I would still call it more like weather modification as opposed to geoengineering, but they were thinking in terms more of climate. A lot of the goal was to heat the earth, particularly in places like Russia where it is quite cold and they wanted to like have more agriculture. But they also wanted to shade the tropics and just ideally, they wanted to create a world where everything was like 70 degrees.
Hey, LA, baby.
Yeah, it'd be good all the time. But at the same time, the USA was also developing its own weather modification programs. And would you be shocked to know that a lot of them were for military applications?
Come on, Nicole. Are you trying to tell me that the US military was willing to do an experimental thing to the earth in hopes of having an military advantage over other countries?
Boy, are you about to be surprised by what I'm going to tell you. So we had done some like early weather modification experiments around agriculture and like precipitation in the American West, kind of the same stuff that early Soviets were doing. But by the time the Soviet technology became better known, it became a national security concern for us.
Oh, yeah. It's an arms race. It's a nuclear arms race.
Yes, although in this case, the nucleus in question is in a cloud. It's the seed of a cloud.
Wow. Way to bring it back,
Thank
Nicole.
You so much.
Best in the biz.
So I found some conflicting dates about the start of this, but basically around 1966, 1967, the United States started doing cloud seeding in Vietnam. Mm. This is part of something called Operation Popeye. Yes, great Popeye.
Thank you.
And basically what they were doing is doing cloud seeding to extend monsoon season so that roads would get wiped out and Vietnamese troops couldn't get supplies.
Good God.
Yeah. Yeah. And
we still and America won that war, right? As a result?
Famously
overwhelming technological superiority, they won the war.
Now, I want to say we may not have won the war, but the battle, well, pretty successful. I got this from the Office of the Historian from the Department of State. This is a memorandum from the Deputy Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, Kohler, to Secretary of State Rusk. From 1967. Will you read this highlighted in yellow part for me? This is about Operation Popeye.
The results are viewed by DOD as outstandingly successful. Okay, awesome. 82% of the clouds seeded produced rain within a brief period after seeding, a percentage appreciably higher than normal expectation in the absence of seeding. The amount of rainfall induced by seeding is believed to have been sufficient to have contributed substantially to rendering vehicular routes in this area inoperable. Okay. Since the end of the rainy season, the communists have failed to undertake route repairs, and there has been no vehicular traffic.
Yeah, so Operation Popeye, big success.
Wow.
It rained a lot and troops couldn't get supplies, and that was not great for the Vietnamese.
Hey there, a little inside baseball. We record this very podcast at the Climate Town office. And if you're not familiar with Climate Town, it's a YouTube series we make for as cheaply as possible. And that means schlepping our camera equipment all over New York City.
Yes, our backpacks are full, and the gear we reach for every time is Peak Design.
That voice you just heard is Ben Bolt, the executive producer of this podcast and of Climate Town.
That's right, Riley.
I mean, this is an ad, but we are genuinely loaded with Peak Design gear, from backpacks to sling bags to camera camera accessories. And by we, I usually just mean Ben. Ben literally has like 7 things from Peak Design on during any given shoot.
Yeah, really. I mean, they make good stuff. My freaking phone case from Peak Design. My phone charger on my desk. That's Peak Design too. My out front bike mount that I can put my phone on. Guess what? Peak Design. You know that little tripod we use on Climate Town shoots?
The little travel tripod?
The little travel tripod. They got organizers. They got straps, clips, duffel bags, everyday bags.
And they're not fucking around. Peak Design gear is guaranteed for life, whether you buy it firsthand or 10th hand.
And they can make that kind of commitment and not go broke because they build stuff to last.
As my father would say, it's built like a brick shit house. And now I'm hearing it out loud, that term is a little dated.
Peak Design is a certified fair trade B Corp that prides itself on recyclable materials, and it lobbies lawmakers in D.C. for environmental legislation. They're also the group who nominated Climate Town to be an environmental partner with 1% for the Planet, so double thank you. And they also have been a podcast supporter of ours from day one. And also, they just make really good stuff.
So go to peakdesign.com/playbook. That's peakdesign.com/playbook for 20% off some of our favorite products and a picture of Ben on set dripping with Peak Design gear.
I'm literally going to try to put as many pieces of Peak Design gear as I possibly can into one picture.
I'm glad we just got health insurance because Ben's back is going to be demoed.
But not because the Peak Design stuff is heavy. The other shit that we put inside
it. Well, in bulk, it's heavy.
If you
stack enough
all...
Peak Design stuff.
Yeah, okay.
I'm not saying it's heavy gear.
They got a
sweet
shoulder strap. It really takes the weight off your shoulder.
It's going to crush you to death.
If that's how I got to go, sayonara.
So Operation Popeye took place during the Vietnam War, 1967 to 1972. They flew 2 sorties a day, which is a word that I just learned. And a sortie is a plane trip.
Oh.
Which feels like they could have just said that.
Or flight.
Yeah, flight. 2 flights a day, 2 missions a day.
Maybe they said, I flew 2 flights a day. No, I can't use the word fly twice in a sentence. Let's
call
make up a
sortie.
New thing.
Yeah. 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 So this went until 1972, and then in 1972, a New York Times article made this tactic public, and it was incredibly unpopular.
Huh.
Can you believe that? That people were like, hey, don't cause flooding in another country, please. For a war we already don't support.
Were they worried about, in any way, about, like, the implications of messing with clouds that maybe it would have big effects? Or was it mostly like, please stop murdering these people more with new creative methods of murder?
I don't know about public opinion, but I have the article in front of me. It's called Rainmaking is Used as a Weapon by U.S. Very straight to the point. Love that headline. This is before clickbait.
Yeah.
And it's by a guy named Seymour M. Hersh. And he won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the Vietnam War. So he was like the guy. And he talked to people at the State Department who had not been informed about like what was happening with cloud seeding. And one former State Department official who said he was concerned that rainmaking, quote, might violate what we considered the general rule of thumb for an illegal weapon of war, something that would cause unusual suffering or disproportionate damage.
Man, I gotta say, there should not be just a general rule of thumb for what's an illegal weapon of war. They should really nail that down.
Yeah.
Also, can you imagine being like a guy who hasn't been briefed on cloud seeding and
we're
being
doing
like,
what?
Yeah, it's like, I don't think we could do that, dude. Okay, we're doing cloud seeding. Sure, yeah.
So this was unpopular both like within the State Department among people who didn't know about it and in the public when they found out about it. And it ultimately led to something called the Convention on Prohibition of Military or Any Other Hostile Use of Environmental Modification Techniques. And if you're thinking that's a mouthful, you're not the only one because they shortened that to ENMOD.
ENMOD.
ENMOD, which really just feels short for environmental modification and not any of those other words.
I mean, I love the military or any other. Like that really closes the loophole that people might have tried to walk through.
Yeah, well, if some guy was like, well, but surely I can be hostile to Vietnam.
Right.
The text of the bill says, states parties undertake not to engage in military or any other hostile use of environmental modification techniques having widespread, long-lasting, or severe effects as the means of destruction, damage, or injury to another state party. And this was signed by a bunch of big countries, notably the United States and Russia both signed it. Later, once China became more of an economic power, they signed it. 30-some other countries have all signed it. So it's not every country in the world, but all the big ones are basically like, okay, we're not doing environmental modification anymore. Now, this could be partially because they felt for the Vietnamese, but it could also be partially because it had some unintended consequences.
Zoinks!
From the same piece from the Office of the Historian, Raleigh, will you read the pink highlighted section?
Sure. In one instance, the rainfall continued as the cloud moved eastward across the Vietnam border and inundated a U.S. Special Forces camp with 9 inches of rain in 4 hours.
Oopsie.
Oh, boy.
Oopsie. In fact, they go on to do the green highlighted portion.
If anything, the tests were too successful. Neither the volume of induced rain nor the extent of area affected can be precisely predicted. The only absolute control, therefore, is after the fact, i.e. to halt cloud seeding missions.
Oh.
I guess it's a little bit like when they started using mustard gas and then the wind changed and it just like blew right back into their own.
Who could have
seen this
coming? Yeah. But on that note about how, oh no, the toothpaste is out of the tube and maybe we should have considered all of our actions. Let's talk a little bit about the different types of geoengineering and why you want to keep that toothpaste in the tube for as long as possible.
Now, is cloud seeding, we consider that geoengineering?
We can. So the first type of geoengineering that we're going to talk about is reflecting the sun away from the earth. And cloud seeding increases the earth's albedo. Raleigh, you got a master's degree in climate and policy. Can
Fuck
you tell
yeah.
me what albedo means?
Of course, albedo is the shininess of the earth. It goes from 1, very shiny, to 0, very absorbent.
That's exactly right. Way to go, Raleigh.
Thank you so much. It also sounds like a little too much like libido.
I agree.
I don't like either word particularly. Yeah. Anyway,
regardless, albedo is basically the shininess of the earth. And there's a lot of stuff that we can do to increase the earth's albedo. Cloud seeding is one of them. When you make clouds bright and white, they reflect the sun away from the earth. One of the reasons that there's tipping points associated with climate change is as the polar ice caps melt, they become less and less reflective because there's less white area. And the albedo of the earth kind of naturally changes with the weather cycles and just the sun's natural cycles, as we've talked about in previous episodes. But the albedo of the earth does naturally change, but there's also many ways for us to change it ourselves. And when you talk about geoengineering, most often what you're talking about is solar geoengineering with the use of sulfate aerosols. And that is what this book, The Planet Remade, is mostly about. He does talk a little bit about other kinds of geoengineering, but that's like the main premise. And sulfur aerosols can be suspended in the stratosphere of the earth, which is the layer of the atmosphere that's right above the troposphere where we live. The stratosphere is like right above where airplanes fly. It's right around the ozone layer. And if you put sulfate aerosols up there, they're quite reflective and they will protect the earth from all of the sun's radiation hitting it.
Gotcha. A shinier planet is colder than
because it's reflecting more of the sun's radiation back into space.
So when we're talking about global warming, we're like, this is bad. We're getting too warm. If we can make this planet a little shinier, we'll get less heat in and we will cool it through shinifying the planet.
Yes, exactly.
Albedoizing it.
Yeah, put a little shine on that planet.
Spit shine. Okay.
Yes. And we have like real life examples of this where we know it works because it's a natural process that happens in volcanic eruptions. A lot of times the one that you'll hear referenced is this huge volcanic eruption that happened in the Philippines in 1992 called Mount Pinatubo.
Pinatubo.
It was a very destructive, very big eruption.
Shouldn't have shouted it like that.
And it ejected 20 million tons of sulfur dioxide aerosols into the stratosphere. And according to the USGS, after the eruption, Earth's lower atmosphere temperature dropped by approximately 1 degree Fahrenheit. So the science of sulfate aerosol particles as geoengineering is solid in that, like, yes, it definitely has the effect of reflecting the sun away from the earth and cooling the planet. That's like not in question. This kind of geoengineering is often recommended because the cost of sulfur oxides is quite low. And when I say quite low, I still mean like $2 to $2.5 billion a year. But that is more cost effective than other kinds of geoengineering. But we'd also need to develop new planes for release at the proper altitude, which would be at least another $2 billion. There's no existing aircraft that has the combination of like altitude and payload size that can do what we would need to do right now.
So this $2 billion plan, like what is it encompassing? Is it just America? Is it the whole world? Like whose plan is this?
So this specifically refers to a peer-reviewed study in a journal called Environmental Research Letters that is like a hypothetical look at what a worldwide geoengineering strategy would be. Right now, there's not like an actual plan among governments to get geoengineering off the ground, no pun intended, because it's like a logistical quagmire, which we'll get to in a minute. But this is based on this one peer-reviewed study. And I think you'll understand why I think it's a little bit of a logistical quagmire when I tell you that this is per CBS News. In their hypothetical plan, the fleet would start with 8 planes in the first year and rise to just under 100 within 15 years. In year one, there would be 4,000 missions, increasing to just over 60,000 per year by year 15.
Wow, that's a ton of flights, but that's not an impossible amount of flights. So this is like a feasible plan to actually do solar geoengineering.
I mean, kind of. We don't really have the technology for it. We don't have planes right now that'll do the payload and altitude combination required. Mm. And we certainly don't have 60,000 planes that'll do it.
Well, that's 60,000 sorties, Nicole.
That's true.
We only need 100 planes or something. I don't know. This does not seem at all technologically out of our range. Like, I think that if people were like, yep, money is no object, Boeing, get your act together.
Boeing's had a lot of problems lately. Can we really get Airbus or somebody to do it?
Well, what you need is stuff to fly out of the planes, right? Like, this is going to be perfect
for
them.
Want something to fly out of the plane, then Boeing is your company.
Boeing is that. They're actually doing some geoengineering. They just swapped the doors, and that's what happened on that flight.
Yeah. Yes, it is possible that if we, like, really put our backs into it, we could get solar geoengineering off the ground, this time, pun intended. Relatively soon it could work, but again, it's a logistical quagmire and there's a lot that we don't know. And the big issue with this kind of geoengineering is we don't know what the consequences of it are going to be.
The consequences are we solve climate change, Nicole. Next problem. Let's tackle world hunger.
Climate models are getting better at predicting what might happen if the stratosphere is full of sulfates, but there's so many unknown unknowns that we can't put them all in. And I think an important thing to think about is, we talked about this in the Heat is Better episode in season one, climate change isn't just about the temperature going up. Mm. If that were the only problem with climate change, like, that would suck, but we could figure it out. A big part of climate change is it causes extreme and unpredictable weather events, and that could happen with this kind of geoengineering also. Changing temperatures lead directly to impacts on weather, and there are models that are starting to indicate these extreme weather impacts of sulfate geoengineering. Mm. One recent one that I found at a website called Physics World.
Physics World. Take your kids down to Physics World. They'll love those 6 balls on a string that click and clack back and forth like Magneto from the X-Men. They're going to love the slide where you slide up.
I would have loved that when I was a kid.
Yeah, that would have been pretty rad.
But they, Physics World, covered an experiment from MIT's Department of Earth, Atmospheric, and Planetary Sciences about geoengineering models. And the researchers were, quote, interested in how injecting aerosols into the atmosphere would impact the pole to equator temperature gradient in both hemispheres and the effect that could have on extratropical storm tracks. These are regions in the mid and high latitudes with heightened incidences of storms known as extratropical cyclones, which play a significant role in determining the day-to-day weather conditions in many parts of the world. Mm. So basically that means, like, when you change the temperatures in places, you change the weather patterns. A lot of big storms are formed when differences between hot and cold interact. And I'm intentionally being vague because sometimes it's air and sometimes it's water. It's like storms can form in a few different ways.
Yeah.
And what this study found is that a weakened storm track in both hemispheres would mean weaker winter storms, which is great, but also lead to more stagnant weather, which could affect heat waves. Mm. And the researchers also said, across all seasons, this could affect ventilation of air pollution. It also may contribute to a weakening of the hydrological cycle with regional reductions in rainfall. These are not good changes compared to a baseline climate that we're used to. In the southern hemisphere, changes in storm track intensity could impact wind-driven ocean circulations and affect the stability of Antarctic ice sheets, the researchers warn. This work highlights that solar geoengineering is not reversing climate change, but is substituting one unprecedented climate state for another.
Wow. That feels like the highlight of this episode to me, where it's like, oh, we can geoengineer ourselves not out of climate change,
but into a new climate change. Yeah.
It's like, let's roll the dice on this one.
Yeah.
Also, like, I remember hearing about the Mount Pinatubo eruption, mm-hmm. and then, like, the next year or the next 2 years of crops were fucked.
They have, they being scientists, they've found a connection between volcanic eruptions in the northern hemisphere and extended drought and, like, lower crop yields, like, around the Sahel.
Well, because you're blocking out the sun.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, that's, I mean, sorry, sheeple, but the sun is plant food. Like... It's also CO2, but it's also the sun.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
We are putting CO2 in the atmosphere, and that's causing the sun's heat to be retained. But the solution is not to, like, then, oh, we'll just subtract some sun and that'll balance
yeah,
it out.
That
it's like they're two different variables.
Right. There was this article that is a little bit old. It's from 2008, but it was very helpful to me in thinking about this episode. It's from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. And the title, conveniently, is 20 Reasons Why Geoengineering May Be a Bad Idea. Mm. And they do talk about the effects on plants.
That's a very 2008 title, by
yeah.
the way.
Oh, yeah.
It's a listicle.
We did geoengineering, and you'll never guess what happened next.
Yeah. At 3:08, we geoengineered so hard, we LOL'd.
And the article does talk about the effects on plants, and that is like a big unknown. Mm. There's some evidence to indicate that more scattered, diffuse light, which is what would happen in a geoengineering scenario like this one, might be good for plants, but it also lowers the overall level of sun that's reaching the plants.
Yeah, which is the point,
yes.
right? Like, we are cutting the sunlight
yes.
to reduce the heat. And, like, that's what plants need. Sorry.
Yeah. So that is, like, one of many unknown impacts. Another big one is acid.
Hell yeah, dude.
Yeah. So,
plants doing acid?
Yeah, dude. They're going to Burning Man.
What am I even growing for, bro?
Sulfur aerosols in the stratosphere can lead to acid rain. It increases the acidity. Now, assuming that the sulfates are evenly distributed over the entire Earth, it might be diluted enough to not really matter. But what if it's not? You know, what if the jet stream congeals all the sulfur over one country specifically and causes acid rain in a country?
Not us. Yeah.
But if that happens and we've done geoengineering, then who pays for it? Like, who helps compensate those people? Who, like, what?
I think Mexico said they'd pay for it.
And even if the acid is evenly distributed, it might not worsen pollution in existing urban areas, but in pristine wilderness, even a little bit of change in the pH level of the soil can, like, cause big consequences.
Mm.
So even if we're lowering the overall temperature, we could be doing something like screwing up the Amazon rainforest, which would not be ideal generally.
And those rainforests have had it too good for too long. I feel like we just need to take them down a peg.
And one other big problem is you got to keep doing it basically forever. Because it doesn't lower our emissions. It doesn't lower the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. So unless it's also accompanied by wide-scale decarbonization, you have to keep doing it. Because sulfates fall out of the air within a span of years. And if all of a sudden they're gone, the planet heats back up real fast.
Ooh.
That's actually worse than global warming initially, because part of the reason things haven't been more unstable is that it's heating up at, like, a relatively steady rate. It's exponential, but it's not like we're suddenly flipping a switch, which is basically what would happen if all of the sulfates fell out of the atmosphere.
Gotcha. Now, I will say, here's a fun fact. The burning of coal in the world also puts sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere, which is sort of this, like, little devil's bargain that we've been doing, because that is reflecting sunlight. So the CO2 and the sulfur dioxide are kind of counteracting each other a little bit.
So we should keep burning coal forever.
I mean, the thing is, like, we have already been masking the amount of warming we've been baking ourselves into with this extra sulfur dioxide. And now that, like, we're kind of reaching peak coal, some of that sulfur dioxide is falling out of the atmosphere, and we're heating up even more because we're no longer masking all of the heating we already put out there.
Oh, boy.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
But I got to say, I'm happy to hear that the sulfur dioxide comes out of the atmosphere because the...
Just in the form of acid rain.
Well, I mean, it's sort of better than the plot of the movie The Matrix, when they, like, all the robots were solar powered and they're, like, in a war with the robots. So they block out the sun with geoengineering.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Oh, yes.
Is this Reloaded?
This is, Nicole, this is the plot of The Matrix 1.
This is regular
Do
Matrix?
Do you not remember the moment where Neo took the blue pill, I think?
Here's Sorry that geoengineering wasn't the main thing that stood out to me about The Matrix.
It was the reason why the robots had to make batteries out of people.
I guess I just didn't need that extra layer of justification. I was like, they're robots and they're evil and they somehow power their bodies with us.
Fine, bend
the spoon with your mind.
Well,
can we
anyway,
get the Merovingian in here?
Merovingian. You speak
that's
French.
That's how the Canadians say it.
Anyway, that is the plot of The Matrix, is that they geoengineered too hard and then they couldn't get it out of the air. And then the robots turned all the people into batteries, which is not a thing that can happen.
Well, maybe we just haven't invented it yet.
That could be true.
That'll be Bill Gates' next job.
I hope so.
Yes. So, yes, it does eventually come out of the air, which is good, but also you have to keep doing it forever if you're not going to cut your emissions. Mm-hmm. Aside from, like, all of the, you know, unknown weather and scientific implications, there's also, like, a diplomatic quagmire. I feel like I've used the word quagmire several times.
You just watched a lot of Family Guy recently.
Giggity, giggity, giggity. it's like a big diplomatic problem. Do you remember when we fucked up Vietnam's clouds?
I mean, I remember from half this an hour episode? Ago when you told me about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm almost not doubting that it happened. I'm sure it did happen. We fucked up a lot more than Vietnam's clouds.
America historically has done quite a few bad things, which raises the question, who sets the thermostat? You know, who's the one who determines how much geoengineering
Daddy.
We do? Daddy. And he sets it cold.
Yeah.
He sets it cold.
Says put on a sweater.
But like who determines that, you know? And if there's fallout from it, who takes the blame? This also like probably violates NMOD, even if we're not doing it for hostile purposes, because somebody is always going to kind of get the short end of the stick in a big international agreement like this. So you have to navigate that. And if you're doing all of that diplomacy and figuring out emissions levels, maybe you should just do that with CO2 emissions. Maybe you should just spend all of your diplomatic time doing that.
Yeah, I guess this is like, well, there's no way we can work together to figure out our CO2 emissions, so let's work together to figure out a way more complicated thing.
A whole new
thing.
Kind of emission.
Yeah.
It's really complicated. Now, in this book, The Planet Remade, his solution, when I reread it, I was like, how did this book convince me so hard? He talks about something called the concert, which is where a bunch of small island nations will band together to secretly build runways and develop their own planes under the guidance of a philanthropic billionaire. And they would sort of do it quietly by themselves. And then when the bigger countries got mad at them, they would be like, you can't stop us. Because historically, countries like America and Russia have been really cool with little countries doing whatever they wanted. He proposes such a complicated solution and goes way into like, here's what would happen in the first year. Here's what would happen in year five. Here's what would happen in year 10. And it's like, it's very specific and detailed. And it's like, I don't know that any of this is really a good prediction. And also relies heavily on like a kind billionaire shepherding this whole process along.
I mean, like, so this was also a plot point in Ministry for the Future by Kim Stanley Robinson,
which is the book that you got me for Christmas that I haven't read yet because I'm reading Don Quixote, which, as it turns out, is very long.
But it's also good.
It's really good, but 900 pages.
Yeah. I mean, there's a great Wishbone version you could just knock out in half an hour. Anyway, so in Ministry for the Future, India just does it.
Yeah.
And it's like, my first reaction, I think, too, is like, well, I don't think other people are going to allow that. But it's like, that's the thing about sovereignty. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't stop India from flying planes over international waters and doing this. You know, like, I'm not saying India's going to do it. Kim Stanley Robinson very much is in that
but
book.
It does violate NMOD, and I don't know off the top of my head what the enforcement for that would be, but I mean, countries, again, like China, Russia, and the United States have all signed that, so if they view that as a threat to them in some way, then they can take action against India.
I guess that's true. I guess they'd be like, They would have to make a lot of declarations. I don't know. There's like currently a country violating the Geneva Convention right now. Multiple, actually. And other countries aren't like stepping in because of all the entangling alliances and also like a bunch of other shitty reasons. So I don't know. I mean, like, it seems pretty possible that a country would just be like, nope, we're doing this. And like, could probably do it to some degree before the missiles started.
They could, but again, are they going to be able to do it at a level that is effective? and that will last long enough to not like cool the planet and then rapidly heat it back up.
I mean, no way. I mean, like, and that's the other problem where it's like, you got to do this a bunch of years in a row.
You got to do it 60,000 sorties, Raleigh. Do you think Bhutan is going to be able to do 60,000 sorties on its own?
I have them down for 10. Okay.
In order to do this the right way, and I'm doing big air quotes, I know it's a audio medium, so you can't tell.
Do them closer to the microphone.
Can you hear? Can you hear? But to do it like the right way, you would have to like have very even cover over the course of however long it takes for us to get our emissions down. And that would require a ton of international cooperation.
Yeah, we're not talking about the right way. We're just talking about doing it.
And then you're dealing with all of these unpredictable consequences that like could make extreme weather worse. Hell or yeah. Bad in
or
a
better,
different way.
Or way better. And that's reason enough for me. Let's fire up those planes, Bhutan.
I mean, like that is ultimately why geoengineering, I think, is so compelling, is that like, yeah, we probably could go up there with a bunch of sulfates right now. Like we've seen it with the volcanoes, but like there are untold consequences that we don't know about.
Right.
Like logistically, it just seems like it's not a realistic solution diplomatically, technologically, to be hanging our hat on at this moment.
Oh, and we keep saying solution, but it's really just like, shit, there's a spider on our arm, cut the arm off. You know, it's like that's not a solution. Yeah, you know, it's a mitigation strategy.
And geoengineering is often framed as like, this is a problem. It is a faster moving problem than people realize. And this could be a way to buy us time to get our emissions down.
Mm.
And I don't think that's necessarily a bad argument. I also don't think we would probably get our emissions down super fast.
Yeah.
One way that you might be able to think about geoengineering is like, it's a little bit like chemotherapy for the earth, where it's like, you're injecting your shit with poison and you just have to hope that the cancer dies before you do, you know? Like it's not good, but like devil's advocate, if we're bumping up against 3 degrees of warming and this is our last option on the table, should we do it? I think probably, yeah. But I also think because there's so many other consequences, most of which we can't predict and don't know about, it has to be like our ejector seat last option.
Right. And there's so many other better ways to mitigate the scenario.
Yeah.
That like just because a bunch of tech guys like it, because it can sort of be executed by a smaller group of people than a lot of people working together, does not mean it's like a good, viable thing to do.
Yeah. And the same article about 20 reasons why geoengineering might be a bad idea points out that like one concern is the commercial control of the technology. You know, who would end up controlling the geoengineering systems? Governments, private companies holding patents on proprietary technology, and whose benefit would they have at heart? These systems could pose issues analogous to those raised by pharmaceutical companies and energy conglomerates whose products ostensibly serve the public good, but who often value shareholder profits over that public good. So, I mean, like, let's say that we're doing geoengineering and then one day the investors are like, this actually isn't making us any money that we can see. So we're pulling the plug. And then suddenly all the sulfates come out of the atmosphere and we experience rapid warming again. One thing I've been reading about a lot lately is how maintenance is much more expensive than building something in the first place. And that's why so much of America's infrastructure is crumbling. And because like politicians can't run on maintenance like isn't sexy. And if we're not doing the necessary work to maintain a service road, I just don't see us doing the necessary maintenance to fly 60,000 sorties into the stratosphere every year. And again, like cooling the planet at all costs, I think is like a valid argument. But when the sulfates fall out of the atmosphere, which again happens quite fast in a planetary scale, like within a span of a few years, your temperature skyrockets much faster than it has been. And that creates incredibly unstable weather, which has immense human costs.
Yeah, and it's also like a thing you have to keep on doing forever as opposed to a solution where it's like, oh, we are going on clean energy and we've pulled some of the CO2 out of the
atmosphere. If I were convinced that like, oh, we're like within the next 10 years, within the next 20 years, we're going to have really good renewable technology that'll be widespread and we'll be totally off fossil fuels. I could see an argument for doing some geoengineering in the meantime, just to like buy us a little time for that technology to develop. But I don't think that that's the bottleneck that we're hitting in terms of reducing CO2 emissions. I think a lot of it is more about political will. And I don't know that buying more time is going to like really serve us in that way.
Yeah, I don't even think I would try to buy the time with it, because we don't know the implications of what trying to sulfate up the atmosphere would be.
Yeah.
So, Nicole, I think you're being reckless.
Okay, I will pull back my order for those super lightweight aircraft with a big payload.
Somebody call Bhutan.
They're going to be so disappointed when I tell them I'm pulling funding out.
They were getting so jacked up.
But there is another kind of reflective geoengineering that we should talk about. And if you thought that putting particles in the stratosphere sounded ambitious, how would you like to go into outer space?
Ooh, very much. Thank you.
Yeah, that'd be a lot of fun, right?
Yeah.
Well, you're in luck, because we're going to talk about that parasol IUD situation that we were referencing at the top of the podcast.
And I'm not entirely sure that's going to stay in. So,
but I do want to keep this reference to the IUD in here.
Great.
This article just came out in the New York Times a few days ago called "Could a Giant Parasol in Outer Space Help Solve the Climate Crisis?"
Man,
you see the difference in article titles when you go from the 1967 "Rainmaking is used as weapon by U.S." to 2024. Could a giant parasol in outer space help solve the climate crisis?
I've said it before. Every time there's a question in a title, the answer is no.
The answer's no. It's a good rule of thumb for journalism.
Can apples kill you?
So the way that giant parasol or space mirrors, which is sometimes it's space mirrors, sometimes it's a sunshade, the way that it works is you'd put up a huge set of mirrors or shades at something called a Lagrange point.
Of course.
Which I learned about while
researching
this. I know
exactly what a Lagrange
point
is.
Tell me what a Lagrange point is,
Robbie. It's the point at which the gravity of the Earth and the gravity of the moon or sun, in this case, equalize, and you can set something there and it will stay there.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So that means these solar shades won't crash into the Earth like in that movie where the moon crashes into the Earth.
Oh, God.
Which may have just been called the moonfall.
Moonfall.
That's it.
Yeah, it had the guy from Game of Thrones in
it. We're not going to have a moonfall scenario.
I watched it. It bad.
What?
It's aliens. It's super smart aliens. Yeah.
Wow.
It's
that doesn't surprise me. It looked bad.
So bad.
There are some benefits. Like, we can make fun of the solar shade all we want, but the biggest one is that it poses fewer chemical risks than sulfate aerosols. So a lot of the unknowns about sulfate aerosols go away with the solar shade. You know, there's not as much risk of, for example, all of the sulfates coalescing over one area and causing those problems. Acid rain isn't a problem. So there is a pretty good argument to be made. Either way, one of the reasons that it's a logistical nightmare is that if it's a parasol or if it's a mirror, they only last like 50 years up there.
Oh, right. Because like space rocks are constantly flying at them.
Yeah. There's debris in space. Space is very unforgiving. So, I mean, 50 years is like a nice long time. Certainly lasts longer than sulfate aerosols. But also, getting to space is hard.
Yeah. Well, I guess we could try hitting up those billionaires again and see if they want to shoot mirrors into space.
This article is based on like a new hypothetical study that just came out about like, here's how we could do it. And the foundation suggests using raw materials from space and launching solar shade ships, hard to say, into L1, which is the Lagrange point, from the moon, which would cost far less than setting off from Earth, which is great. It would cost less to set off from the moon. We would have to build a space station on the moon.
Finally. I think the author of this article just really wants to build a space station on the moon.
Could you imagine?
Has been writing this same article year after year, like, could aliens be spotted easier? Better build a space station on the moon.
The article also says that the shade would have to be about 1 million square miles, or roughly the size of Argentina. A team is ready to design a prototype shade of 100 square feet. So a lot smaller than Argentina.
Yeah, 100 square feet.
And the 100 square feet spot. Shade.
Like less than a parking spot. Yeah.
And the 100 square feet shade would cost between $10 and $20 million.
Ooh. Well, there's probably a price break at a trillion or so.
Probably. It is estimated that the full-size version would cost trillions. And one of the scientists referred to that as a, quote, tab for the world to pick up, not a single country. So it's nice that we're sort of sharing apps as a world.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Can I Venmo you?
But then the question becomes, like, how much is Nairobi giving to the sunshade versus the United States?
That's the question. I love how that's your the question.
It's the, like, I have yeah,
but
many how, questions.
But freaking, let's how make Nairobi pay for it. I mean, there's a million more questions before you. Like, that's assuming we got the 100 square mile.
Tajikistan, why don't you put in a little bit for the solar mirror situation?
Yeah, Trinidad and Tobago, you haven't kicked anything in for our 100 million square mile. Is that? No, that's not right. How many million square mile?
The size of Argentina, which you should know is about a million square miles.
Yeah, you haven't kicked in for our million square mile space mirror. What an
it's
insane amount of material.
Thing. Well, but that's why you got to take material from the moon.
I got to tell you, I've seen a movie about this. Those moon aliens are not going to like that.
So a lot of the studies on it are like old and very sparse. And so this one study from 2006 estimated that a fleet of meter-sized spacecraft with mirrors on them, meter-sized to cover 1 million square miles. So many spacecraft.
I guess they would like unfurl something.
I guess.
Like a butterfly wing.
It would take 25 years to do that. It would only last 50 years and it would cost trillions of dollars.
I also remember there was an episode of Futurama about where when they tried this and they built the mirror and then a little space rock clipped it and destroyed it.
Yeah. So it's like, it's not practical. One of the scientists was like, what if we attach it to an asteroid? And I was like, what?
We're just brainstorming, Nicole. There's no bad science ideas. Okay. Is it possible horses can jump into space? Has anyone checked?
So in addition to the fact that this is like science fiction and would be an expensive logistical nightmare, the burdens of which would be distributed unevenly over the earth. There's again a huge potential for military or financial control depending on like who is deploying it and who's in charge of it. For example, you would need to be able to adjust it, like, because if you get it up there and you can't adjust it and it doesn't work, then that sucks. So you need it to be kind of like a Venetian blind that you can adjust the angle of.
So the Italians are going to do it.
Exactly. So if you need that adjustability, like, what's to stop the country that controls it from, like, requiring payment, you know? Like, oh, your country's too hot? You got to pay us a gazillion dollars and then we'll, you know, turn your heat down a little bit.
Jeez, that is a really, that would be a wild UN meeting.
It'd be crazy.
I also, like, we haven't really talked about this, but, like, 60,000 flights or, like, the amount of rockets that it would take to get all this shit into space, like for the space one, that's a lot of carbon emissions.
Yes, and yes, and I can't tell from a lot of these studies if they are taking into account the emissions that they would put into the atmosphere when they're talking about like how much it would cool the planet.
I mean, they're using monopoly money. I bet they're accounting for it, but they're just like, yeah, fuck it. Throw another 10,000 flights in the air. I don't care. It's all fake anyway. Because Nicaragua is not going to pay for it.
Well, speaking of which, like, unlike sulfates, it would be almost impossible for smaller countries to meaningfully participate in this action. Like, sure, Nicaragua can give, like, a little bit of money compared to the amount of investment like the United States and like Russia and China would have to put into it. But if they don't have as much capital investment, it would be really easy. For example, if we cool things too much and it fucks with their weather patterns, but it's really helping our weather patterns, it would be easy for us to be like, well, you didn't give us as much money, so you don't get as much say in whether or not you get enough sun.
Yeah, that is true. Like, one nice thing about the sun is that it like affects pretty even-handedly in its distance from the earth. You know, like our ecosystems have worked their way into however the sun affects them. Mm-hmm. And if suddenly like Boris Johnson, who I know is not
back.
No longer relevant, but like I feel like he'd be the minister of the sun or something. He'd like, oh, you know, he the fact that it would be in control of a group of people or a person is like probably not a good way to distribute power.
It's, I mean, when you talk about like controlling access to the sun's power. Like, that's what a Batman villain does.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I know what I'll do. I'll restrict access to the power of the sun.
I mean, that's like, that is every big bad villain in a first draft of like a James Bond film.
I'll block out the sun.
Yeah, of the Matrix did it. You know, like everybody does it.
Yeah.
I think we should viscerally be against it. It's funny that it's like, well, we might have to because we really love these Ford F-150s.
And that's like ultimately why I consider this a piece of climate misinformation, right? Mm. Because the science is real. Like if we put sulfur in the stratosphere, it's going to cool our shit down, at least temporarily. But when we talk about technological solutions like this, when we pin all of our hopes on this technological development, which again is sort of feasible but doesn't exist yet, we're not talking about doing stuff that we can do to actually bring our emissions down, which is what is going to lead to long-term solutions to the climate crisis that don't require 60,000 sorties a year.
Mm. Yeah, it's like if there is the thought of being able to pull this ripcord, then there's a lot less onus on the world's governments to actually change their behavior.
Yeah. And I feel confident in saying that because, again, that's what happened to me. I read this book, The Planet Remade. It's as I was getting really interested in climate change stuff and as I was like changing my life to work in the climate space. It was right before I went to grad school. And this book really calmed me down in a way that I don't think was helpful.
Mm.
I don't think panicking about the climate crisis is helpful either. But I also think that I can't be the only person who reads a very compelling book about geoengineering and is like, oh, it's okay. Like,
we'll
figure out how to fix it. That's always an option.
Yeah.
And again, I do think if we get to a point where warming is like way beyond what we even predicted, we're probably going to have to pull the ripcord on geoengineering.
Mm.
But that is going to cause a lot of its own problems that we can't predict. And I think if 2017 Nicole knew that when she was reading this book, I don't think she would have been quite so hype about it. And I don't know that she would have been quite so dismissive of other people's climate concerns because she's like, I read this one book about geoengineering.
Yeah, I think people feel the same way about like the carbon capture thing. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, we'll just suck it out of the air. Oh, we'll just like dampen the sun a little bit. And enough of these like fake solutions are swimming out there that people feel like, oh, okay, we got a handle on this. Technology is going to save us. And by the time it gets to that point and we realize like technology will not save us, we're going to be in a real dire strait.
Yeah. Yeah. There are a lot of groups who are benefiting from climate action in a lot of different ways. Like I would say like the land back movement, which is very much associated with climate, is having real benefits for, you know, native people in America and other countries. I would say that finally, like topics of environmental justice, particularly when it comes to like disadvantaged communities living next to power plants, things of that nature, that is all associated with the climate movement. We're working to make their lives better. And when you approach this as a technological problem alone and you cool down the planet without taking those people into consideration, then we keep reinforcing the systems that cause environmental harms while making life easier for the people who aren't affected by those things.
Right, right. And just to be clear, like, we have not given that land back.
No,
you know,
no, no,
like
no,
we
no,
have
no,
not
no.
like replaced it.
This is when I say the land back movement,
like
I mean like
the
we're,
words
we're,
are together.
Yes,
we're in
it's like people are pursuing that as like one of a plethora of solutions to the climate crisis. And it's like for the first time, we're finally talking about it.
Right.
We're getting
right.
closer to it in a way that we've never been before. And to then suddenly be like, oh, the global warming's not a problem anymore. Like those people stand to lose a lot in terms of environmental justice.
Right. All right, Nicole. Now, normally we do like a little Thanksgiving bit where mm-hmm. we sort of do like a family Thanksgiving role play.
Mm-hmm.
But this is season two. We're going to change it up a little bit. We're going to just do like a little free form sort of riff scene. Now, Nicole, between the two of us, we have spent 10K on improv lessons.
Easily.
So we got to nail this.
Yeah.
All right. So I think the setup could be like you are a sovereign foreign nation and I'm a billionaire trying to convince you to do geoengineering.
Okay, great.
And we'll just sort of...
I'm going to do an accent like this. This is a white foreign nation, to be clear.
Yeah, that was clear, but which one?
It's one that doesn't exist yet.
Okay. What is it? It's sort of got a...
It's a little German.
A little German, it's a little Austrian, maybe. Okay, yeah. That's nice. Yeah, it's sort of unnamed. Yeah. It's like the African general. It's like, what country? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so you are an unnamed Nordic sort of...
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, thank you so much for letting me in here. Your tea is disgusting, but I drank the whole cup. So.
It's our ancestral tea.
Wow. Well,
we
leave
make it
there.
With lye.
Leave it in the past.
Okay.
Okay. Anyway, hey, so you know me. I have over $40 billion.
Yes.
And I have taken it upon myself to solve the climate crisis, partially because, yes, my fortune is built on oil money, and I did largely cause it.
Uh-oh.
Wow, you must have learned English from watching 90s television.
I sure did. Did I do that?
Well, I did do that if you're talking about the climate crisis. And so I'd like to put things right. And I have a little proposal for you. How many planes do you have in your Air Force?
Our Air Force?
Yeah. You know, like, how do you make sure that smaller countries, you keep your boot on the throat of smaller countries around you?
Oh, we're the embooted country.
Oh, well, yeah, someday you'll get up and you'll put a shiny boot on, you'll put it on the throat of the countries around you.
Oh, I can only imagine.
Well, and I can kind of help you out with that. So what we're going to do is we're going to buy you a whole bunch of airplanes.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. And we're going to take those airplanes and send them into the atmosphere.
Okay.
And then we're going to just spray a potentially acidic sort of gas.
Oh.
Very willy-nilly over international waters to blot out the sun.
Okay.
And that's going to, I think, do a pretty good job of absolving myself of the white guilt that I feel.
Okay. I have a few questions.
Sure. Yeah, sure.
Number one.
Do you mind if I sit?
Sure, go ahead.
Now, is this a chair or what's going on over here, this fluffy white thing?
That is our national mammal.
Oh, wow.
The Plutuskint.
Well, it is not moving very quickly.
It's hibernating.
Oh, jeez, okay.
You can sit on some such, but we sit on.
Wow.
In the winters. Okay, question number one. So my country is now going to spray acid.
That's right.
Into the sky.
Not acid yet. The acid will form in a couple of years.
Sort of a pre-acid.
Yeah, you could think about it like that.
Okay, what if people get mad at me?
Well, the lovely thing about national sovereignty is that if we're over international waters, it's pretty hard to make you stop doing things.
Okay, what if another country uses their international sovereignty to punish me?
Well, I think
in some fashion.
I think if they did that, that could be considered an act of war, and then you could ask one of the many vaguely Nordic countries around you to go in a coalition of the willing, and you could sort of bomb them and take their oil.
So you think that another Nordic country is going to come to my defense for spraying acid?
Well, can't you just force them to with the might of your mighty military?
No, I think you are not understanding what it means to not have military.
I feel like I don't even know what country we're in right
you
now.
You and me both. Okay, question number two. We've had a lot of really bad storms recently.
Oh, yikes.
This isn't going to cause any more extreme weather events for us, is it?
Well, it will, yes. But I think you can think about it like you're doing a real favor for me.
Okay.
And I have, I don't mean to brag, $40 billion.
Right.
And I'm kind of the kind of guy you want to do favors
for.
And plus, if you personally are feeling like these storms are affecting you, I can just fly you down to a place that doesn't have storms.
Okay. But
I can fly all you and this little gross little sticky white murder monster.
He shouldn't be sticky.
He's sticky as hell.
Oh, boy.
I did pour a bunch of honey on him earlier.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense. This is the honey season.
So how many planes can I put you down for?
Okay, I have to ask a quick question.
Yeah.
What?
I do have to go after this. I have a handful of other Nordic countries to pitch this idea to.
Oh, geez. Okay.
So it's kind of a take it or leave it sort of situation.
So let's say that after maybe 2 or 3 years, we decide that this isn't working out well for us.
Okay.
There's no commitment that we need to make to keep doing this for the next 60 to 100 years,
There's no commitment beyond the absolute ironclad necessity to continue doing it for probably as long as I'm still alive.
Oh.
And I do use my son's blood to
replace my own blood. You were going to be that billionaire.
Yeah.
Do you think... Okay, brainstorm, pitch, blue okay. sky thinking.
I actually don't like the term blue sky thinking because we are going to be blotting out the blueness of the sky. It's going to be more red sky.
That is actually literally a side effect of geoengineering.
I mean, I know. I love this plan.
Yeah. Okay. So no bad ideas. What if you stopped taking your private plane to the 7-Eleven? What if you stopped putting up so much carbon?
And instead I took my private plane and I dumped a bunch of acid all over international waters. That's a good question. I have thought about that. I have a big skiing tournament later on
that I
have to go to because the slopes are kind of melting. And so I kind of got to get all those in now.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got an appointment to meet my new wife.
Oh, an appointment?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean... For sort of fingers crossed, new wife. I'm auditioning a handful of people.
Good luck.
Yeah, good luck.
Okay. I think that probably we're going to pass on this opportunity.
Oh, I was worried you were going to say that, and I will say, you will be hearing from my lawyer.
What?
Who's my dad? The Climate Deniers Playbook was created by Raleigh Williams, that's me, Nicole Conlon, and Ben Bolt.
Our hosts are Raleigh Williams and Nicole Conlon, who is me, and our executive producer is Ben Bolt.
The show is produced by Gregory Haddock and edited by Brittany Terrell.
Our researchers are Carly Rizzuto, Knut Haraldson, and James Krugnail.
Theme music from the smooth, sultry mind of Tony Dominic.
And artwork by Jordan Dahl, who, yes, is technically my boyfriend, but that's not why we hired him. He's actually just really good at art.
Special thanks to the Civil Liberties Defense Center.
And to all of you who actually listen to the show.
And apparently even the credits.
Now that's dedication.
Is it possible horses can jump into space? Has anyone checked?